All right, this is Gary Parrish again from CBSSports.com again, and let me welcome you to the Ion College Basketball Podcast again, which is now brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial, by the way, and 10% off, go to squarespace.com/CBSSports and use the offer code FUN. That's FUN at squarespace.com/CBSSports. All right. Now, watch this segue, boys. Speaking of fun, let's go ahead and get into today's Ion College Basketball Podcast, which is going to be mostly dedicated to a very specific topic, specifically the topic of coaches on the hot seat. On Monday's podcast, you might remember I told you that I would, with the assistance of Jeff Borzello and Matt Norlander, record a special hot seat edition of the podcast on Thursday. Today is Thursday, so here we are. But before we dive into lots of talk of buyouts and replacement candidates, I do want to look back at Wednesday night's games really quickly, because Wednesday night was wild. So let's start with some news and notes brought to you by Squarespace. No, number one, Syracuse, of course, lost at home to Boston College. They were like a 14-point favorite over BC. BC was ranked around 190th in the RPI at tip-off. They're still outside of the top 150. So, as I wrote late last night, after I landed in Raleigh, after not seeing a minute of the game, after not even knowing it was happening because my plane didn't have Wi-Fi, I landed to a barrage of text messages and tweets and that kind of stuff. Syracuse went from, in a span of a couple of hours, one of the last two remaining undefeated teams in Division I basketball to the only team currently ranked in the top 20 of the AP poll that also has a loss to a team outside of the top 150 of the RPI. So this was a historically bad loss for a number one team. Matt Norlander, you tell me exactly how bad was it?
I think it's, hey, I'm good to talk to you guys. I think it was pretty bad. I mean, pretty remarkable, too. There are all sorts of historically amazing things tied to this outcome. I mean, it was the first time since 55, according to ESPN stats and information, that a team with a sub-500 record won on the road at a number one ranked team. BC had the lowest winning percentage of a team ever to beat a number one ranked team, period. And obviously, they had only beaten Virginia Tech since before Thanksgiving. They had two wins over D1 teams. Both those teams were Virginia Tech. Remarkable. And I want to note, like, people say, you know, Syracuse was, you know, they were playing with fire. This was a long time coming, so to speak. And if you want to say that, that's fine. By the way, they dipped down to 9 in KenPom because of this. And they dipped from 1 to 4 in your top 25 and 1. But no one thought this was coming. I mean, and that's what makes it all the more amazing. And now let's just remember that Syracuse has 4 of its final 5 on the road. I find it virtually impossible to see how they get to the ACC tournament with only one loss. They're gonna drop a game. Duke, Virginia.
They're gonna be underdogs this weekend.
I think Virginia's gonna win the ACC regular season title. Considering they lost to 35 to Tennessee back right before conference play, their schedule kind of opens up well. And Syracuse's loss last night, the only tough game for Virginia. I mean, they host Syracuse. I think they should win that game. They go to Maryland. I think they could win that game. But for Syracuse, you know, I think we've talked about this before. If Syracuse had lost to Duke on Saturday, I think you maybe would have either, you know, maybe dropped them to number two.
No, I would have kept them number one.
Yeah, or kept them number one, right. You wouldn't have been a big difference. But losing to BC, that's a huge knock on the resume. And when it comes time to, you know, compare for number one seeds, you know, they're going to have a worse loss than anybody. And I think that's going to be
by far.
Yeah, it's not even going to be close. So, you know, if there are five or six teams in contention for that number one seed, that loss to BC last night could be the difference between number one seed and number two seed.
Yeah, and like, just so we're clear, like, when people say, because I've heard this already as well, you know, Syracuse, you know, they were lucky to win at Pitt, and they were fortunate to get by NC State, you know, so they were playing with fire, right? Well, playing with fire means that, like, you might lose to NC State, you know, because NC State's a top 80 team at KenPom, or you might lose at Maryland, right? That's what playing with fire is. This losing to Boston College thing at home, that's not, even if you are playing with fire and playing with gasoline at the same time you're playing with fire while blindfolded, you still don't get burned here. You know, you still figure out a way to get past this. And so it was just, again, like I actually landed. My plane had no Wi-Fi. I mean, I'm in Raleigh, North Carolina, by the way, right now, because I'm going to be at the Duke, North Carolina game. But I was always going to be at the Syracuse-Duke rematch at Cameron, because once Syracuse got past Pittsburgh, it seemed pretty clear, like it seemed overwhelmingly clear, that they would be undefeated going into Cameron Indoor. And then last night happened. Let me ask you this, Porzella. Should Florida now be number one in the top 25 and one and everywhere else when they update the rankings? Is that the way this should go?
I think so. I think they've proven it. I do think that there's a case to be made for Wichita State. I know people don't like their schedule, but you know, as we saw last night, you can lose to anybody, and Wichita State hasn't done it yet. But I do think Florida is the best team in college basketball right now. They're playing the best right now. I think they're the title favorites right now. So yeah, I do think they should move to number one.
They got a good scare at
home.
They
did.
Sure. And you know what, GP, you didn't see it, or maybe you have seen it since you landed and there's video up, but Auburn had a brutal final 20 seconds, boneheaded foul with a tie game going. So the Gators were really close to losing, even though they didn't. And so if you want to make the case Wichita State should be number one, I think that's fair. And by
Florida hasn't been steamrolling teams either. Like, I mean, they won at Kentucky, but they've had some, they've had some close wins lately too.
Right. And Wichita State for the most part has been, you know, rolling over the valley. By the way, you know, I just can't believe still how much, and we don't have to go into this again too much, but how much just disdain there is for Wichita State.
Like, so much hate.
From writers, from fans, it's odd. It's straight up weird how people really just don't want to give this team its due. But as I said last night, when Syracuse is falling at home to a BC team that was 6-19 entering that game, and Wichita State is continually just whipping on teams, it's really time to start giving them a lot of respect for what they're doing, because you just see how hard it is. I mean, if you can get picked off anywhere. I mean, Florida almost lost at home to Auburn, you know?
So, like, you know, and I made this point last night, when, you know, if your big thing with Wichita State is all they do is beat bad teams. Well, you know, we saw last night, and maybe it was an anomaly, like a complete, of course it was, right? But we still saw you're susceptible to losing to practically anybody. I mean, that was crazy what happened to Syracuse last night. But still, Wichita State has played 16 teams with better RPIs than the Boston College team that Syracuse lost at home to last night. And they've obviously handled every one of them. Combine that, you know, the fact, just being 28-0 on February 20th, with the idea that, you know, their win at St. Louis, I know people don't want to get excited about that for two reasons. A, it happened a long time ago, but B, because it's St. Louis and it's not a power conference school. But winning at St. Louis is comparable to winning, you know, at Pitt. You know, it's comparable to winning at, you know, Wisconsin. It's comparable to winning at Michigan State, at Cincinnati. You know, like if you go to the KenPom rankings, St. Louis is smack between Michigan State and Cincinnati. They're right in the middle, right? So if Wichita State was sitting here with this record and a win at Michigan State, people would go, okay. Or a win at Cincinnati, people would go, okay. Or a win at North Carolina or Kentucky or Ohio State. But for some reason, because it's St. Louis, even though St. Louis is grouped with those teams, it doesn't resonate. I just think it's stupid at this point.
Well, every time you point out that their one big win is at St. Louis, people start, you know, banging on St. Louis and how bad they are, and they haven't beaten anybody. It's just a bad non-power conference domino that goes on. But quick note, looking at Ken Pom's strength of schedule, Wichita State's strength of schedule is better than Cincinnati and Louisville.
There you go. Look at that.
And so, like, at this point, like, people
not saying it's, you know, they've played tough teams, but there's other teams that have played bad schedules too.
Yeah, and I think strength of schedule can be a manipulated stat.
That's fair.
Yeah, but still, like, the point is, they're 28-0. It's February 20th. They haven't lost to anybody like Boston College, and they've played them a bunch. They've won at St. Louis, which is comparable to winning at Ohio State, Michigan State, or some of these other schools that people respect. I just, listen, if you want to continue to doubt Wichita State, you're just dumb. Like, that's it. Like, you're a dummy. Now, what I hate about this is that they're going to get a one seed. And then they're, you know, let's be honest, they're probably going to lose in the Elite Eight, you know?
Which is fine,
but here's the problem.
They have to make the Final Four.
Well, like,
in order for people to be like, I told you so.
This will be my thing. If you want to after a 40-minute basketball game in a single elimination tournament that they might lose in the Elite Eight, say that Wichita State was a fraud because they lost in the Sweet 16 to the Elite Eight, fine. As long as you're willing to do that to everybody else who gets upset in the tournament. Yep. As long as you're willing to apply the same logic to everybody else who gets upset in the tournament, then I'm fine with it. So if you want to call Indiana a fraud, was Indiana a fraud last year? Of course not. Yeah. They just lost a 40-minute basketball game in a single elimination tournament.
They did cut down nets, though.
They did cut down nets. They had two lottery picks, two top five picks. They were great from start to finish. Then they lost in the NCAA tournament. Nobody called Indiana fraud. So I can see the way this is set up, right? It's set up so when Wichita State loses in the Elite Eight or the Sweet 16, people say, see, they suck. They don't suck. They've never sucked. But that's sort of the nature of that tournament. Just as long as you're willing to hold everybody else to the same standard, I'll still think it's dumb, but I'll at least call you consistent. If you apply dumb logic inconsistently, that's the type of stuff I'll
You'll
do.
Give them their due, yeah.
Okay. I'll do an hour long podcast about it. All right, now let's get into it. The hot seat portion of the podcast that I promise. As you know, if you follow college basketball at all, this is the time of the year where some coaches have already lost their jobs and others are fighting like hell to try to keep theirs, often against all odds. So here's what we did, Jeff and Matt and I. We between the three of us, decided to come up with a list of 15 coaches whose future seemed to be the most uncertain or whose fans seem to be the most restless. It's not necessarily a list of the 15 guys we think should be fired. It's just the 15 guys whose situations, I guess we could put it like this, we find most interesting. And I don't think anybody's situation at this moment is more interesting than Travis Ford's situation. So let's start right there. You know, I wrote a column earlier this season specifically about how Marcus Smart had saved Travis Ford's job, career, by first coming there, but then by B, staying a year longer than most people anticipated. Now, oddly, not being able to control Marcus Smart, combined with, you know, an unfortunate injury to Michael Cobbins and the dismissal because of arrest of Stevie Clark, that has Oklahoma State losers of seven straight games. The Cowboys are actually ninth in the Big 12 standings, and just so we know, there's only 10 teams in that league. They've gone from the top 10 to the bubble of the NCAA tournament, and there's some thought that Travis Ford could pay for this collapse if he doesn't get things turned around. Matt, what do you think of that?
I think it's valid. I think I don't know if we're going to hit on all 15 coaches in this podcast that we are going to have a story on CBSSports.com you can read, but I think there's only one other coach that I hear more about fans wanting to leave among the ones that we're discussing here than Ford, and I think people realize that, but we'll talk about that in a little bit. So, yeah, I think it's very valid. I mean, when you have this kind of skid, that's the problem that can come with high expectations here. You know, think about what they were in the preseason, Final Four hopefuls. People thought they'd win the Big 12 over Kansas to what this team is now. And obviously, it's not just the Smart stuff. And by the way, the three-game Smart suspension won't absolve Ford if they fail to make the tournament. I think there is a genuine situation here where there could be so much unrest there among the fan base that they might have to do something. It's not one of the most likeliest, but certainly it's the biggest hot button coaching situation in terms of, I think, fans really itching for a change. Deserve it or not, it exists.
If they miss the tournament, it will be missing the tournament at Oklahoma State for the third time in 4 years, and this time after a preseason top 10, 15 ranking, wherever they were. Certainly at one point they were ranked in the top 10 early this season. Listen, my gut tells me he's going to be back. My gut tells me they're going to get this turned around. They'll make the tournament. He'll be back. He'll be back under pressure next year.
I think Smart's going to save his job again.
But one thing that would concern me is that, you know, this is a school that has fired a coach after 2 years and after two NITs. So if you go, you know, three missed NCAA tournaments in 4 years, you're not at a school that doesn't have a history of pulling a quick trigger. Obviously, they've got the money to buy you out, and it would take a lot of money to buy you out. But still, that would sort of be in the back of my mind. Listen, these guys here, they pulled the trigger on Sean Sutton really quickly. You know, would they be willing to pull the trigger on me if we missed the tournament for the third time again in 4 years? Let's talk James Dickey for a moment. He's a former Oklahoma State assistant and current head coach at Houston. Borzello is it's really turned on him there. He had it, I don't know if having people excited, that's probably not the right way to phrase it. This is Houston basketball and not with Clyde and Olajuwon. But recruiting was going well. But then he lost a key member of his staff, and now that's not where it was a couple of years ago, and the on-the-court product just quite simply isn't very good.
Yeah, and the AAC has turned into sort of a, you know, the have and have-nots. You know, the top five teams are good, the bottom five teams aren't good, and I think that Houston needs to, you know, turn things around in order to be competitive again. They have talent, and it's just not turning out well. And, you know, you mentioned top recruiter Ulrich Maligi. He's at SMU now. He's the one that landed Daniel House and Chicken Knowles and those guys, you know, the talented guys on the team. You know, it's just, you know, they're not doing anything. You know, they need a change. You know, there's just no excitement, you know, around the basketball program. I don't know, you know, if there was even before he got there, but, you know, there was a gaudy record last year, but this year, they, you know, they could finish below 500. And, you know, Texas is kind of a hotbed for high school talent. And I think that Houston has to get their hands on, you know, some of those guys in order to turn it around.
I like James a lot. Like a lot. He's a nice, genuinely nice man. But this hire always seemed weird to me. And here's why. Nothing to do with James. I just think it's a young man's job. I, you know, that is a job where you've got to, you know, like I was talking to Tim Miles the other day from Nebraska, and they have facilities. They have, you know, fans now, 14,000 season tickets sold out. They've got a budget to properly compensate high-level assistants. Like, everything is in place at Nebraska except what? They don't have a natural recruiting base. Like, you have to sort of go outside of your area and steal players from other parts of the country or to be able to create a program that can compete, you know, in the top half of the Big Ten. I say that to say that at Houston, you've got a natural recruiting base. Like, you've got tons of players right there. And I think it that job is a job where I would hire the best young recruiter with Texas ties I could find. And I'm not just saying that now after, you know, Houston is sitting here struggling in its first year in the American Athletic Conference and honestly struggling for the fourth straight year, unless you want to call last year's 20-13 record some sort of success, even though they finished, I guess, tied for seventh in Conference USA. I would have said this before they hired James. I think this is a young man's job. Norlander, you see any way he survives it?
Probably not. Borzello specifically mentioned Texas. I'll say Houston, too. I mean, Houston's been an area that's got a lot of talent, and it's kind of vital for that program to be able to bring in, even if it can't, you know, nab the five-star products, you know, the four-star ones on occasion. And if you got a guy named Chicken on your team and you're not winning and you're not relevant, that's a huge issue. And I will say, by the way, that this is a program that, you know, guys our age, and I'm including GP in that,
Thank you.
We don't know Houston as a viable program.
I actually can remember Houston as a viable program.
Really?
I can remember because you know, I grew up in Memphis, and Memphis played Houston in the NCAA tournament one year. I think this is true. Memphis State, and there's a clip, you could probably YouTube this, of Clyde Drexler dunking over Andre Turner, like jumped over him, just like jumped over him. I don't mean dunked on him. Like, there's two different things we're talking about here. Dunked on somebody, that's one thing. I'm talking about jumped over the dude.
Yeah, he Vince Carter'd him, right.
He Vince Carter'd him, right. And so I remember that. I remember that moment. I remember, like, my parents and people around, like, going, my God, did you see Clyde Drexler jump over little Andre? Like, I remember that. I have a memory of that, but it goes back a while. We're talking, yeah, we're talking, like, early 80s.
Yeah, exactly. And that's when you were just a little kid. But, like, they made one tournament since 92, and that actually came 5 years ago, which I don't even remember them making the tournament, which is kind of maybe speaks to me, but also to Houston. So point is,
Tom Pender's going to be so disappointed in you.
It's been dormant. It's been dormant for so long. It really, really needs an invigorating hire in a new league. And I don't see Dickey lasting.
Remember, you're listening to the Ion College Basketball Podcast, which is brought to you by Squarespace, where you can easily create your own professional website or online portfolio. You know, Squarespace is constantly improving its platform with new features, new designs, and even better support. They got beautiful designs for you to start with, and all of the style options you need to create a unique website for you or your business. So Squarespace is obviously easy to use, but they still have an amazing support team available 24/7. It starts at just $8 a month, and you can actually start a free trial with no credit card required, which means you can start building your website today. When you decide to sign up, again, for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code FUN to get 10% off and to show your support for the Eye on College Basketball Podcast. Really cool, Squarespace, to jump on board the Eye on College Basketball Podcast. I obviously appreciate it. That Squarespace, everything you need to know. I mean, everything you need to create an exceptional website. So we're talking today on the Eye on College Basketball Podcast about coaches on the hot seat. Again, Matt Norlander and Jeff Borzello are with me. We've already talked about Travis Ford, who currently works for a school that has a history, like I said earlier, pulling a plug quickly. Another school with a similar history, because of what it did with Dino Gaudio, is Wake Forest. So let's start talking Jeff Bezdelic for a moment. If Dino Gaudio got fired after two straight NCAA tournament appearances, Norlander, can you explain to me why Bezdelic should keep his job after what looks like is going to be another miss of the NCAA tournament?
This is the guy I was referring to. Wake Forest, in terms of fans outcrying to have the head coach removed, I don't think there's been any fan base remotely close to what Wake Forest has put out in the past 2 years in wanting Bezdelic to leave. I mean, erecting billboards, organizing, you know, protests before Wake Forest football games. He seems to have a pretty good relationship with the athletic director, but I just don't think that he can survive this. Right now they've lost six in a row, 4-9 in the ACC. He doesn't rally the fan base whatsoever. It was interesting to know earlier this year when they end up beating? They got that win over North Carolina in early January, and at the time, you know, Wake was an 11-3 team. It was their first game in the ACC. They ended up winning it. A woman came up to Bezdelic on the court after and was like crying and hugging him and saying, thank you, thank you. Remember that?
They beat Carolina. Yeah. Then they beat NC State. Then they also beat Notre Dame. And at that point, they were
14-6, so they're above 500 in the ACC. And then they became Wake Forest again.
Yeah. So now they've kind of dipped. The fans have never liked the hire from the start, and they've kind of been vocal. So to me, I just don't see how he survives it, especially if they keep falling like this. They'll have evidence, and then, I mean, there could be true rioting in the streets of Winston-Salem if he comes back next year.
I actually didn't mind the hire. I remember when this went down and people were like, oh, here's why. Let me tell you why. With no opinion on Jeff specifically, I thought it was neat that an athletic director was willing to, like, do two things that are so uncommon, because presumably he had this core belief in something. So, like, you just don't fire guys after 2 years of the NCAA tournament. Like, Dino went to, I think it was two straight NCAA tournaments and then got fired, right? So you just don't do that. And so people are like, how could you fire Dino Gaudio? And sort of from where I was sitting was like, that's a fair question. I like Dino, and he was obviously doing, I don't want to say a great job, but he made the tournament 2 years. But I was like, okay, but like, what if, like, because athletic directors typically rely on stuff like public opinion. Like, well, if you do, like, you hear this all the time. If he makes the NCAA tournament, he'll keep his job. But if he doesn't, then he won't. Well, to me, that's stupid. Like, if you got the right guy, keep him. If you don't think you have the right guy, even if he makes the tournament, move him. Like, you know, like, use your head a little bit. Don't set some arbitrary line in the sky and say, if you touch it, you keep your job. And if you don't, you don't. I mean, I understand that's how it works. I just always thought that was a little silly. So you had a guy here in Ron Wellman saying, listen, I don't care if he's gone to two NCAA tournaments. I don't, you know, in the past 2 years, I don't think he's the right guy for the job. So I was like, okay, like, at least you got an AD putting his neck out there a little bit. And then he goes and hires Jeff, who was coming off three straight losing seasons at Colorado. And you never see that. A guy basically upgrading job after three straight losing seasons. So you can understand why people were going, what on earth? You just fired a winner to hire a loser? What are you doing? But like, from my perspective, I was intrigued by the whole thing. I was like, wow, you got an athletic director who is firing somebody you wouldn't normally fire based off of a resume, and hiring somebody to replace that guy you wouldn't normally hire based off of a resume. This is really unique. And so I was like, I actually wrote a column applauding Ron Wellman. I was like, yo, man, I don't know if this is going to work out, but you got some balls about you, you know, to pull this off. The problem, of course, is if you're going to put yourself out there like that, it better work. And this has not worked in any sort of interpretation. And so I can't believe they brought Jeff back for this year. And you can understand why the fans are crazy, going crazy. I mean, this is where Chris Paul went to school, for crying out loud. I mean, this is a good basketball program, a historically relevant basketball program that is just a complete mess. So I cannot imagine any scenario under which Jeff comes back for, I guess, what would be a fifth year. But I think the larger question is, like, you know, if you're the athletic director and you, like I said, put your neck out there like this, how do you survive something like this? I mean, how do you, listen, yeah. I know he's otherwise respected, but this is a mess. And when you combine all of that with the idea that, you know, it wasn't just he hired Jeff because he saw something in Jeff. I mean, I guess that was part of it. You wouldn't make a bad hire intentionally. But, like, they're best friends. Like, they go back to college days. And so this has been a really bad stain on what I think is an otherwise respectable resume for Ron Wellman. Norlander, what do you make of all this?
I think he's done. And, by the way, he is the – just a quick note on Wellman. He is the chair this year of the NCAA Tournament Selection Committee. So this has actually been a big year for him personally, and no doubt stressful. And that job takes up a lot of your time. So I don't know how much impact that will have on, you know, his day-to-day communique with Bizdelic or anything like that. But I'm just noting in a very turbulent year for Wake, its athletic director actually is also the spokesman for the 10-person NCAA selection committee.
All right, let's stay in the ACC for a second. Steve Donahue last night, of course, got a big win at Boston College, but he still only has 7 this year. Borzello, listen, I know this is a nice moment for him, right. but is it a sign that of anything other than just a weird 45 minutes of basketball? Do you see Steve getting another year at Boston College?
Not at all. No, I mean, he made the NIT in his first season there, but he's done nothing since. And last night obviously was nice, but, you know, they've still been a huge disappointment. They came into the year with some optimism. You know, Ryan Anderson and Olivier Hamlin were, you know, 2 of the maybe 10 best players in the ACC. But, you know, as we talked about earlier, they'd beaten 1 Division I team since November before last night. And, you know, their AD, he was hired in 2012. So, you know, it's not like Donahue's his guy. And I think he's going to look for somewhere new. And it wouldn't be surprising to see Donahue end up back at Cornell, you know, where he led them to success before coming to BC.
Norlander in the ACC, Brad Bernal at Clemson. He's in his fourth season now. Obviously, has missed the NCAA tournament each of the past 2 years after going in his first year. They went 22-12. The fans, I thought this was a good hire when it happened. It still might end up being a good hire, but the fans email me all the time. Not all the time, that's overstating it. But I've received multiple emails saying, Parrish, I thought you told us this was going to be good, replacing Oliver Purnell. And it, you know, we'd be lying if we said it has gone the way anybody anticipated, including Brad. Norlander, can he get another year at Clemson?
I think he can. I think they're in the NCAA tournament. I mean, right now, it's up in the air. They're in the mix for an NCAA tournament bid. They're not in, according to almost everyone, but 16-9, above 500 in the ACC. He has made a tournament since he got to Clemson his first year, only 1 year under 500. This was one of bigger names, not right. But when we talked in the preseason about guys we thought were on the hot seat, Brownell was clearly, if not a top five, a borderline top five candidate. We just thought that they'd have to have a big year. And the team's defense has really saved him. I think if they get to the tournament, he's definitely saved. And if they don't, but they, I don't know, to me, if they don't, but they still end up with a decent overall record, and KJ McDaniels comes back, which he should, for an amazing senior season, I think he gets one more year.
I think he'll get one more year at least to prove that he's the right guy for the job. All right, let's do one more in the ACC. Say what you want to about Seth Greenberg. But he at least had Virginia Tech relevant. You know, they were on the wrong side of the bubble more often than on the right, but they were on the bubble since they removed Seth Greenberg and promoted James Johnson. They're not close to the bubble. They can't even see the bubble from where they're sitting. Borzello, explain to me why James Johnson should get another year.
I don't think I can. You know, when he first took over, He was a longtime assistant. He couldn't keep the best players that Virginia Tech had, Montrezl Harrell and Dorian Finney-Smith.
And that's a problem because, like, when you hire, when you promote assistants, like,
you do it for continuity, yeah.
You usually can keep everybody on board. Yeah. That was the first bad sign to me. Like, you couldn't even keep their own guys.
Right, and I think that was the huge thing. And they don't have enough – there's just not enough ACC talent on the roster. Brand new AD. I think he's going to make a change. It's just, you know, he – you know, I don't think this was a good first job for James Johnson. It was, you know, throwing right into the ACC with a team with not a lot of talent. I think it was, you know, he was kind of set up not to succeed just talent wise and what was on the roster. So I don't think he's going to be there next year.
Another guy who is under pressure, or at least often criticized, a former ACC coach. We talked about Brad Brunau at Clemson. The guy he replaced was, of course, Oliver Purnell. Norlander, my homeboy Oliver Purnell, is now in his fourth year at DePaul, and I don't know if he was ever in a good spot to get this turned around, but he has not got it turned around. Is OP going to get a fifth year in Chicago?
OP, man. Well, you know what? Despite the odds, if anyone can get a fifth year in Chicago, I think it's OP. But now DePaul's gone full DePaul. They've dropped, 10 games straight, 9 games straight, 2-12 in a Big East, which is obviously reformed and not the Big East of old. This team, this program, man, it's kind of, honestly, it's vexing and kind of sad. They haven't made a tournament in a decade, and they've only made 2 over the past 15 years. I think he should go personally, but I can't go full on that he will go because this is Oliver Purnell.
He's got to go.
GP, throw out the stat. It's one of the greatest stats ever in college basketball.
He has been coaching at the Division I level since 1988. Since 1988, he's never won an NCAA tournament game, never been fired.
That is vampire blood. I don't know.
OP's the best. OP's the best. I hope he coaches forever. You know what? I'll say about the DePaul job the same thing I said about the Houston job. I like Oliver Purnell. Like, I named my son after Oliver Purnell. I didn't really name my son after Oliver Purnell, but his name is Oliver. I've known Oliver since he was, you know, at Clemson, obviously. I've spent time with he and his wife. Like, I like Oliver Purnell. But this is not working, and I thought the same thing when DePaul hired Oliver that I thought when Houston hired James Dickey. Like, that's a young man's job. You've got anytime you have a program that is drifted to levels that it shouldn't drift to, but still has a natural recruiting base available, and Chicago and Houston are both great recruiting bases. I think the right move is to get a young, aggressive recruiter and let him just go try to collect players and win some games that way. So I was surprised when DePaul went this direction because nothing to do with Oliver. I think Oliver he's been consistently a good Division I basketball coach. But I just don't know why you hire an older guy at DePaul when you need to dig DePaul out of some hole that it's been in for way too long, given the recruiting base that's available and the league affiliation that's always existed. I think this is a young man's job. I think Houston and DePaul should both have two of the youngest, quote, power conference head coaches in America who are known as awesome recruiters. In fact, like, I would call, if I were the AD at either one of those places, I would call somebody like Jeff Borzello and I would say, tell me the three best assistants, young guys, at recruiting Chicago. Three best assistants, young guys, who are recruiting Houston or Texas in general. And that would be those would be the people I'd be looking at.
DePaul's not bringing any recruits next year that are good. They lose a bunch of seniors. So next year, I mean, they're going to be bad either way. And they, you know, to me, just starting fresh, you know, with somebody to replace Purnell. He's making too much money to keep him. He's making like $2 million a year.
And by the way, just
God bless him. How about that?
I know.
A quick note here. One of the best players of the past 20 years in DePaul, statistically, Cleveland Melvin, he left the school kind of abruptly in the past couple of weeks. So don't really understand what the situation there is. It just might be one of those things where you see, might be some unrest. Why is like one of the guys that basically your best player just straight up leaving school in the middle of his senior season? That's not a good sign either.
Well, that's the other problem. It's like, okay, it's bad, but you know, I'll listen if you can explain to me why it might be better next year or the next year. But there's no evidence that this is going to change, which suggests that that there probably needs to be a change. Let's go to the SEC. You know, we got four guys there at least whose job status is, if not uncertain, is at least debated, if not nationally, then certainly locally. Tony Barbie being the most obvious, like we talked about earlier. They almost got a win at Florida last night, but that's, you know, almost doesn't really matter much in this sport. You know, we talk about it just not working for whatever reason. This isn't working for whatever reason. Tony's now in his fourth year. They're going to finish near the bottom of the SEC again for at least the third straight year. And they really the fourth straight year. They've never been good. 4-12 in year one in the SEC, 5-11 in year two, 3-15 in year three. They're now sitting here with another losing record. And I don't know that there's any evidence that it's going to be better. They've got a brand new facility that's really, really, you know, beautiful. They've given Tony the money to go out and hire, you know, prominent assistant coaches, Ryan Miller being one of them. I mean, he was able to get Ryan to come from Missouri to Auburn. Now, some of that is because those two, you know, have a long history together. They worked together for John Calipari at the University of Memphis. Still, you know, in a bottom line business, the bottom line isn't good. Any chance Tony Barbie gets year five?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that, you know, he's done nothing since he got there. Hasn't finished above 500 since getting to Auburn. He does have 3 years left on his deal, but, you know, they have enough money to buy him out from football. You know, people say, does Auburn care enough about basketball to really make a change? And I just think you have to. He's just done nothing to really bring any optimism to the program. And, you know, they had some success about a decade ago, a little more. And I do think, you know, there's enough, you know, I guess talent down south where you can get it back to that. So I do think they need to make a change.
Only 8 NCAA tournament appearances in program history, the most recent in 2003. Not a particularly proud program. Needs a really strong hire. The SEC is mired in mediocrity, and it's a lot of it's because of programs like Auburn, which just can't climb out of the hole, so to speak. But they need someone that can at least scare the teams at the top. So I think it is time for a change.
Mark Fox at Georgia, he's in his 5th year right now. They're actually sitting at this moment 8-5 in the SEC. They're in sole possession of third place. Now, I'm not a big believer in league standings. I rarely even look at them, particularly in the leagues where there's an unbalanced schedule. But that's a nice bullet point if you're trying to argue in favor of Mark Fox. How is Georgia going to move a coach who is sitting here at 8-5 in the SEC on February 20th? Still, you know, he entered this season on most people's, quote, hot seats. Has Mark done enough to get off of it, Norlander?
Maybe. Honestly, I'm not sure. I think he's an up in the air guy right now because he's third in the SEC right now, 8-5 overall, was 8-4, was a situation none of us saw coming. Obviously, at one point, this team was, you know, 6-6, and it was not looking good. It started the season 1-4. I wonder, I don't know personally, just for transparency, I don't know how good his relationship is with his AD. But, you know, and Mark's also, Gary wrote on this earlier in the season, Mark's a man who's very liked by many in the profession and overall just a really good guy. Lost his father this year. The team has actually rallied since that. I don't know if that human element comes into it at all when you consider how they've done in the SEC. So I actually think it is debatable whether he comes back or not. My question here is, you know, Georgia, kind of similar to Auburn, doesn't have a terrific history in college basketball and making the NCAA tournament. Do you keep Mark because maybe you just what the program is right now and where it is, maybe for consistency's sake and how they've performed this year and if they can win more games and not down the stretch, just try and hold on to the right guy and just see, you know, by sticking with it, if you can build something there. A lot of times ADs don't want to do that. They're afraid to do that. I wonder if that's what they should do in Athens.
I think they will, unless this falls apart. Like, unless it really spirals on them down the stretch. I mean, the other thing is, this team that's 8-5 and in sole possession of third in the SEC right now, basically everybody's back next year.
Yeah, I mean, they have, what, one senior or something?
Yeah,
like that?
I think it's one senior on the team. And so, you know, basically everybody's back. And so I think it would be hard for a school like Georgia. And this is interesting to me. Georgia is one of those programs that everybody thinks, like, oh, wow, you know, Georgia, that's, you know, because
it's better than it is, right?
Nobody ever wins there. Right. Now, you know, so like, you know, do they hire the wrong guy every time? You know, like, you know, nobody really ever wins there at a significant level. And yet everybody thinks that's the place where, oh, man, Georgia, you got access to Atlanta, all those recruits. And yet, for whatever reason, people haven't won there in any sort of significant way. So given the history of the program, I think when you've got a team that could finish, let's just say, in the top quarter of the SEC and returns – you know, practically every important piece from the season into next season. Again, unless this spirals on Mark, I think he's probably
and he's done a good job of getting guys to go there. He's just lost them all to the NBA earlier than expected. But you know, he's been getting talent there.
And here's the thing: like when you say he's lost guys to the NBA, first off, he's lost three early entries to the NBA, yeah. And that's just not something you can afford to do at a place like Georgia. At Kentucky, just reload. At Kansas, just reload. At Duke, Carolina, just reload. At Georgia, it like hurts you when that happens. Mm-hmm. And it's one thing like, you know, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, like, listen, I get that. You're a lottery pick. Go. I don't care whether you're ready. You know, if you want to get paid, I cannot look you in the eyes and tell you you're making a mistake. Go. I get that one. The other two kids that he lost early, Mark, to the NBA draft, they were second-round picks. And typically, as a coach, you are going to keep your second-round picks. Like, they're going to stay in school. And so, if you just go back and look at where they were after his second year, so that was 2010-11, they won 21 games, they went to the NCAA tournament, and was supposed to return, you know, the core of that team. They would have been a preseason top 25 team in the 2011-12 season. But then they lose two players early to the NBA draft, both of whom were second-round draft picks. And that's the type of thing that can just, you know, really set your career back or put your, you know, path to whatever you're going on hold or turn it the other direction at a place like Georgia. I mean, we look around the country right now, you know, some of the teams that are really flourishing, you know, why? Like, look at where would Creighton be right now? Creighton's in the top 10. Where would they be if their borderline first round pick decided, Doug McDermott we're talking about, decided to go pro after last year? Like, where would they be?
Yeah.
You know? Like, this
totally
is
a different spot.
Totally different spot. And so Mark lost two of those dudes. Now, neither one of them were Doug McDermott. Let's not lie. But you lose two borderline guys that, hey, flip a coin. They could come back or leave. And you lose them both. I think that caused what we saw in the subsequent 2 years. This year, again, is respectable. Next year, got basically the same team coming back. I'd be surprised, again, unless this really turns on him late. If Mark Fox isn't back in Georgia next year. Anthony Grant at Alabama, a hire that was celebrated, and it actually got off to a nice start. People like Anthony and respect him. I mean, I don't know if folks remember, but it was a let's not even think about it situation at Florida when Billy Donovan briefly left to go to the Orlando Magic. Anthony Grant was going to be the next head coach at the University of Florida. He didn't get that job because Billy kept that job. He stayed at VCU, I think maybe for another year or two, takes the Alabama job. And when we talk about things not going well, this one quite clearly isn't. He's on the verge, I guess, of missing the NCAA tournament for the second straight season and fourth time in 5 years as a head coach. This team is worse than it should be. You know, this is an Alabama team that was, I don't want to say borderline top 25. I don't know if that's true even, but probably projected by most to be in the conversation for making the NCAA tournament back in the preseason. Instead, they're sitting here 4-8 in the SEC, 10-15 overall. Do they have enough patience in Alabama, Borzello, to give Anthony Grant another year?
I think so. I mean, I know he's only made one NCAA tournament, and they're a huge disappointment this year, but he's still won 20 games three times. I think he's been mostly an upgrade on Mark Gottfried, his predecessor. He only loses Trevor Elliford. I know he's one of the best players in the league, but he's kind of their only big loss for next year. He's got some talent coming in. His contract runs, I think, through like 2019. So I think, you know, he's under contract for a while. I do think they give him another year. The excitement factor, I think, is gone a little bit with him, and there are people calling, you know, for a new coach. But I would give him another year. I think that given his talent next year and the fact that SEC, and this goes for Mark Fox too, the SEC is, you know, we've seen this year that you can finish third. You can compete with everybody but Florida and Kentucky fairly easily. And I think that both Georgia and Alabama will do that next year.
Norlander, Tennessee had to hire a coach under circumstances it never wanted to try to hire a coach after basically, not basically, absolutely firing Bruce Pearl because of NCAA violations in the middle of an NCAA investigation. Trying to follow Bruce was going to be difficult for anybody because he was a big personality and someone who won at that school at an unprecedented level. Konzo Martin, if you didn't know that before, now knows it better than anybody. They are, I guess at this moment, you know, probably going to miss the NCAA tournament for the third straight year after Bruce went every single year that he coached at Tennessee. This is one where I don't know how realistic it is to think that the administration will move him after three seasons, but there's quite literally a petition online of people trying to get Bruce Pearl rehired because his show calls ends with the NCAA this year. Is Tennessee the type of place, given the success of Bruce Pearl, that they should seriously look, if Konzo doesn't get this turned around, at making a change after 3 years?
A couple things here. One, the online petition thing, I mean, that's one person that gets inspired. And there's a little bit of
fan space. No, I will say this. Clay Travis, who is a prominent sports media figure in the state of Tennessee, hosts a really highly rated radio show in Nashville. He's somebody who has a voice. Now, you might not like his voice, but he has a voice in this state and with Tennessee fans. And, you know, he filed a column at his website endorsing the idea of rehiring Bruce Pearl, and actually took calls on his radio show one time. He wrote about this, you know, in recent weeks, and just said, should Tennessee, forget move Konzo Martin, should they move Konzo Martin and rehire Bruce Pearl, who still lives in Knoxville, by the way. And as somebody who hosts a radio show, I'll just tell you, anytime you open up the phone lines, you are never going to get a 100% on anything. Like two people could disagree on whether Bill Self is a good coach. Like, you could open the phone line and say, is Bill Self a good coach? And some idiot would call in and say, I'm not sold yet on that Coach Self over in Lawrence. So, and so I say that to tell you, in a 3-hour radio show, they had 100% yes, fire Konzo Martin, hire Bruce Pearl. So I get what you say about the petition, but this is a conversation that's happening.
I was going to follow it up by saying, but in this case, the fan desire is legitimate. Be here, like, we all have our random like philosophies on things,
sure.
Right? In my opinion, like, it's got to be an extreme case. You should never, no matter the level, ever fire a guy. Never deserves to be fired after 3 years if he is above 500. All 3 years. And Konzo Martin's done that. I actually think Tennessee is going to get into the tournament. But I will also say, I mean, I went on Tennessee radio like 5 weeks ago, and I was kind of, at first I was taken aback. They were like, so Konzo is probably going to be gone after this year, right, Matt? And I was like, what?
Right.
No. And since then, it's kind of gotten more and more. A lot of that is because the talent on this team is so good and they've kind of underdeveloped. I think he should definitely get one more year. But the conversation regarding Pearl returning to Tennessee, I'll admit it's damn intriguing. I don't think it would happen. But if it did, that would be kind of amazing.
I don't think it'll happen either. But I will say this. If you decide to make a coaching change, and by the way, I hate your rule on coaching teams.
You don't like,
I don't like that rule. It's too cut and dry.
It's too cut and dry. I think if you think you got the right guy, keep him. If you think you got the wrong guy, move him.
Yeah, you like the right guy wrong. Yeah, I get you. I know. I think it, like, he's won 19, then 20, and he's probably going to win minimally 19 again. You do that three straight years in a major conference.
You know how many games in college basketball
teams? He hasn't been in a tournament.
I know, but it's still a lot better than a lot of other guys are able to do in their first 3 years. So
not Bruce Pearl.
Not Bruce Pearl. That's right. And Pearl took him to. They've been to six Sweet 16s ever. Bruce Pearl's responsible for half of those. So I totally get that.
Here's what I think. Actually, I think Konzo, like, he is recruiting. You know, I don't want to say well, but good enough. I mean, the roster is not the problem. Like, they got a good enough roster, I think. Robert Hubbs did get hurt. He out for the season. He was their, you know, five-star recruit that they enrolled. Now, he wasn't great early, so I'm not saying that's why this has turned, but there's some things you could point to there. I don't know that if I were in charge of Tennessee that I would make a change, even if Konzo misses the NCAA tournament. In fact, I don't think I would. I don't think I would make a change after 3 years. But I will say this. If you decided to make a change, and I don't think it'll happen, but if you asked yourself this question, just put everything aside and asked yourself essentially the same question that Tom Jurich at Louisville asked himself. Okay, I need a coach. I need a coach right now. of all the people I could hire and introduce, who would be best at ensuring that I make this particular program that I'm hiring for a high-level program? If you ask yourself that question and threw in all the candidates that you could reasonably hire at a place like Tennessee with Bruce Pearl, is there any scenario under which the answer isn't Bruce Pearl?
Pearl, yeah.
It's not even close.
I mean, he's probably the most attractive candidate that's going to be available. I mean, I think him, Ben Howland. I mean, but Bruce Pearl, I think he would bring personality wherever he went. Howland obviously not bringing that same personality. So to me, Pearl is a fit for, you know, a lot of these potential SEC openings.
We've been talking SEC. Let's talk real quickly about a former SEC coach who has already been fired once out of Arkansas. Now he's on the verge of getting got again. Stan Heath at South Florida. Norlander, any chance he gets another year?
I mean, maybe because it's South Florida and they aren't exactly totally buying into the college basketball scene down there. Just not that inspiring. One NCAA tournament run. It was a really bizarre, strangely good team on defense a couple of years ago. But you go this long with only one tournament appearance, and if you're not connected to the United States president, you know, 7 years, 6 years, one tournament appearance, you probably should go. I think he should. I can't say for certain that he will.
Speaking of well, guys,
he got that 6-year deal right after the tournament in 2012. So he's got a buyout, I'm assuming, a pretty big one.
Yeah, but like, you know, this will be year seven, one NCAA tournament.
No, I don't think he should survive either. I'm just
saying. No, I got that. Yeah, but like, they're bad, you know, like, and very bad for the second straight year. I mean, there's different levels of not making the NCAA tournament. We tend to like set that bar up and say, well, he didn't make the tournament, he didn't make the tournament. Well, there's different levels of not making the tournament, and at least for the past couple of years, and really for his first couple, they didn't even sniff it. So it's it's turned the wrong way in Tampa. I actually I think at this point would be surprised if Stan gets another season. Norlander, you mentioned being connected to the president of the United States. That's obviously Craig Robinson. He's at Oregon State. You know, that is a place that I don't know that people scream about Oregon State basketball much, but to the extent that they do lately, it's been about why is Craig Robinson still our basketball coach? There was some thought that he'd get moved at the last season. I don't know that he's done much to alleviate any of that heat, so to speak. Craig Robinson going to be back to finish out his second term, so to speak, with his brother-in-law?
You know, this is one where I feel like he shouldn't, but then, you know, we've talked about this, guys, and by the way, Oregon State fans are definitely fed up. But this connection, I mean, you know, being the brother to the first lady and how that's genuinely kind of helped Oregon State, I guess, you know, all around with publicity. There's a feeling that he's going to last as long as Obama is in office, which, by the way, is just weird. But I can't see much justification for keeping him, but that does not mean he won't stay.
I mean, Oregon State's gotten more publicity in the past, you know, 6 years or whatever than they did before then. I mean, to me, I think he sticks around. You know, like you said, until I think they give him at least one more year. Just because of publicity.
Here's the problem with the publicity. Like, listen, I went to Corvallis, you know, when Craig got the job. In fact, Barack, I can call him Barack. Barack and Michelle's children were actually staying with him. This was before, you know, President Obama was initially elected, but during the campaign. And so, like, I went to, you know, because it's Craig Robinson, it's Michelle Obama's brother, and this is about to be the first brother-in-law, because it was, I think, clear at that point that Barack was going to win the election. In fact, I don't know what the poll said, but I just remember Craig, like, I was sitting in his office at Oregon State, and you know, you get this close to somebody who is that important, and you can't help yourself from talking to him about it. You know, even if you decide in advance you're not going to. And so I'm like, do you think this is going to happen? And he was like, oh yeah, he's winning this. Like, it's not like, I just remember him being very confident. Like, oh, there's no doubt he is going to be the next president of the United States. And so because of all this stuff, I think it contributed to him, I don't want to say getting the job, but getting a look at the job initially. Like, people knew who he was because of who his sister was and who his brother-in-law was. And so that gets you in the picture. And then, you know, whatever happened to help him get the job. So yeah, you get all this good pop. Like people are right. Like I went to Oregon State to write about its basketball coach. I can't imagine any scenario under which I would ever do that again. But you get this initial pop of great publicity. Now it almost works against you because everything that happens, nothing happens in anonymity. Like you don't just lose quietly at Oregon State anymore. You lose with headlines because it's the president's brother-in-law. And so, listen, I don't know whether I've heard the same thing you guys have heard, that the school, the administration is very hesitant about moving the brother-in-law of the president of the United States. But without knowing all the, the things that go into something like that, that seems incredibly stupid from a basketball perspective.
I agree.
Yeah. From a basketball perspective, yeah. He should be gone.
Here's my thing.
Save his job.
Yeah, here's my thing. If you think Craig Robinson is the right guy for the job, by all means, keep him. If you are keeping him just because his sister's Michelle and she's still living in the White House, that seems a little silly to me. Real quickly, let's wrap up the Pac-12. Ken Bone at Washington State. I think we're all in agreement here.
Gone.
Good basketball coach. I don't know how you bring him back again.
There's
no buzz. He's done.
He's done. Johnny Dawkins. Let's wrap up with him. You know, at Stanford. And this one's interesting because I guess I've made clear over the past hour, I'm not a real big fan of people just sort of drawing lines and saying if you cross it, you keep your job, and if you don't, you don't, because I think there's so many things that can go into a thing like that. Like Ben Hallen, you read this last year, and I'm not going to get into the Ben Hallen conversation for the millionth time here, but there was reports out of LA, you know, as the regular season was closing down, that Ben Hallen had to go to the Sweet 16 to keep his job. Well, he lost his, I don't want to say his best player, but one of his best players to a broken foot, Jordan Adams, in the Pac-12 tournament, at which point the Sweet 16 was completely off the table. So ultimately what you're telling me, if that was really the line that you drew, and I don't know that it really was, I think they were just setting lines and they were going to wait for him not to reach one. And when they didn't, they were going to move him. They'd made up their mind. But if that's the barometer, if that's where you're setting the line, what you're by extension telling me is that you fired Ben Hallen because Jordan Adams broke his foot, which is just stupid. Like, again, I just don't think making sort of – I don't think making decisions based off stuff like that is sensible. But the Stanford athletic director has basically said, you know, in the preseason, on the record, which is wild, you know, if Johnny Dawkins doesn't make the NCAA tournament this year, we're going to replace him. If he does, he will keep his job. Again, I don't agree with that approach, but I can appreciate somebody being honest about that approach if it is their approach. So I guess the question is, not whether Johnny Dawkins is going to keep his job. We can make it a little simpler than that. Is Johnny Dawkins going to make the NCAA tournament, at which point he keeps his job? Norlander, you think so?
No. And actually, I think people don't realize how Stanford is somewhat secure in the tournament right now, according to a lot of forecasts in the 10 seed range. They don't, you know, because they haven't really popped to a certain extent this year. But the metrics help them overall right now. I think they have a number of losses coming. I think they're going to drop both their road games to Arizona State and Arizona. They still got to play Colorado, Utah, and UCLA. All those are home games. I don't think they're going to win all of them. So I think they're just going to miss the tournament, and I think that will lead to Dawkins losing his job.
If he does lose his job, I think it's going to be real interesting because they have a top 15, top 10 recruiting class for next year. They have three or four top 100 kids, McDonald's All-American. I think that's going to help Dawkins' cause, but if he's gone, I think we're going to see some serious attempted poaching of these kids.
It's funny. I don't know how many people remember this. Stanford went to 13 NCAA tournaments in 14 seasons under Mike Montgomery and Trent Johnson. So this was a program that it didn't sort of like strive to reach the NCAA tournament. Like that was never a goal. That was just automatic. Like that's where you start. Like, of course we're going to be in the NCAA tournament. Then what can we do? Final Four, championship game, Sweet 16. Making the tournament was never, ever an issue. And yet if Johnny Dawkins doesn't make it this year, that'll be six straight years under Johnny of not making the NCAA tournament, which, right or wrong, is a very, very difficult thing to overcome at a power conference, particularly at a power conference school that has had, in recent years, the type of success that Stanford has enjoyed. Okay, well, listen, I've kept you guys long enough. I've kept everybody long enough. So let me just tell everybody listening that, again, we appreciate you being here for the Eye on College Basketball podcast and for reading what we do at CBSSports.com. interacting with us on Twitter. Remember, you can subscribe to the Ion College Basketball Podcast over at iTunes. It's the quickest way to make sure you get the new edition. So go do that in your spare time. And either way, the three of us will be back Monday. We'll wrap up what should be a fun weekend. I'm going to be at Cameron for Duke Syracuse. The Saturday slate of games is just
loaded. Oh my gosh,
off the charts, right? You get a lot of good stuff. So we'll have a ton of really interesting topics to discuss on Monday. So meet us back here then. Take care.